killed him. Thought he was pulling a weapon that turned out to be a crucifix. It tore her up. She couldn't get it out of her head. He must have thought he was the luckiest son of a bitch on earth. Separated from his unit, badly wounded, unable to do anything but wait for a rescue that would probably never come. And then out of nowhere, this random girl shows up. He was saved. Then the random girl opened up with a rifle and turned his body into a pincushion. "Not your fault, Sullivan," I told her. "You didn't have a choice." "Bullshit," she snapped at me. She tended to snap at me a lot. Well, not just me. The girl's a snapper. "That's the lie they want us to believe, Parrish." Back on Main. Easing up to the corner, I peek around the edge of the building toward the coffee shop. Directly across from it is a three-story. Windows boarded up on the bottom floor, fractured on the top two. Nothing glows in the windows or on the roof. No green balls of light through the eyepiece. I hold for a few seconds, watching the front. I know the drill. That building has to be cleared. We practiced it 1,000 times in camp, only we had 7 guys to do it. Flint, Oompa, Ringer, Teacup, Poundcake, Dumbo. Down to just one now. Down to me. Hunched over, I trot across Main Street, every inch of my body tingling, expecting the punch of the sniper's bullet. Whose bright idea was it to cut straight through Urbana? Who put that guy in charge? Keep moving, stay focused, check those windows up there, those doors over there. The street is choked with trash and broken glass, slick with the residue from ruptured sewer lines and water mains, puddles of oily water glimmering in the starlight. One block over, then cutting back south. The building is straight ahead at the end of the block, and I force myself to slow down. You're taught to stay in the moment, but the moment I'm in is the one that happens after I've neutralized the shooter. Do I abort the mission to find Ringer and Teacup? Get Dumbo back to the safe house? Or leave him here and pick him up later on my way back from the caverns? I've reached the end of the block. Time to make the call. Once I penetrate the building, I'm all in. There's no going back. I step through a broken plate glass window and into the lobby of a bank. A carpet of paper covers the floor. Deposit slips and brochures and old magazines and the remnants of a banner, "Our lowest rates ever," and bills in every denomination. I can see hundreds among the fives and tens. The damp, rotting carpet squishes beneath my boots. I sweep the room in less than 30 seconds. Clear. I find the stairway door opposite the elevator and ease it open. I'm down to zero visibility, but I'm not risking light. I might as well scream out my name or yell, "Hey, bud, here I am!" In the stairwell, the door clicks shut behind me, sealing me inside absolute darkness. One step up, pause, straining my ears. Another step, pause. Faintly, the building groans around me like an old house settling. The harsh winter, the broken pipes within the walls, water worming its way into the mortar, freezing, expanding, breaking apart the bones and sinews that hold the structure together. If the others weren't dropping the bombs in 4 days, Urbana would crumble on its own. In 1,000 years, you could hold the entirety of the city in the palm of your hand. First landing, second floor. I keep moving up, one hand on the metal railing. Step, pause, step. I'll start on the roof and work my way down. I don't think he's nesting up there. Dumbo and I were hunkered by the back counter, and the trajectory from the rooftop into the coffee shop is too sharp. More likely, the sniper's set up on the second floor. But I'm going to be methodical about this. Think through every move before I make it. I smell it halfway to the second floor, on the landing where the stairs turn. The unmistakable stink of death. I step on something small and soft. Probably a dead rat. In the tight, closed-in space, the stench is overwhelming. My eyes pour water. My stomach rises into my throat. Another good reason to blow up the cities. It's the fastest way to get rid of the smell. Above me, a razor-thin bar of golden light shines beneath the door. Holy crap, and WTF. He's a brazen bastard. I press my ear against the door. Silence. Though it might seem obvious, I'm not sure what to do. The door could be booby-trapped. Or the light could be a ruse. Bait to lure me into an ambush. At the very least, the door's gotta be rigged to make a sound if it's opened. You don't have to be a silencer to take that precaution. I drop my hand onto the cold metal door handle. I fiddle with the eyepiece, stalling. You don't ease in, Parrish. You bust through. The worst part isn't the busting through, though. The worst part is the second before you do. I throw open the door, whip sharply to my left, then step into the hall and turn back hard to the right. No bell jingled. No stack of empty cans clatter to the floor. The door swings closed silently behind me on well-oiled hinges. My finger twitches on the trigger as a shadow races across the wall. A shadow that's attached to a small, orange, furry creature with a striped tail. A cat. The animal darts through an open doorway halfway down the corridor, out of which pours the golden light that I saw in the stairwell. As I ease toward the light, the smell of decay is overcome by two very different smells. Hot soup, maybe beef stew, warring with the unmistakable odor of a dirty litter box. I can hear a high-pitched voice warbling softly. When through the woods and forest glades I wander and hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees. I've heard this song before, many times. I even remember the refrain. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Her voice reminds me of another, thin and scratchy from age, slightly out of tune, singing with fierce determination and the self-assurance that comes with unshakable faith. How many Sundays did I stand beside my grandmother while she sang this hymn? Bored out of my adolescent mind, silently bitching about my itchy collar and uncomfortable shoes, daydreaming about my latest crush and sacrilegiously changing, in my head, the last line to, "How great thy ass, how great thy ass." Hearing that song opens a floodgate through which the memories pour, unstoppable. Grandma's perfume, her thick legs encased in white stockings and her square-toed black shoes, the way the powder caked in the deep crevices of her face, at the corners of her mouth and her dark, kind eyes, the knobbiness of her arthritic knuckles, and how she held the steering wheel of that ancient Mercury like a desperate swimmer clutching a lifesaver. Chocolate chip cookies fresh from the oven, and apple pies cooling on racks, and her voice in the other room rising in excitement as the latest bombshells were delivered by a lady in her prayer circle. Stopping just short of the doorway, I pull out one of the stun grenades. I slip my finger into the pin. My hands are shaking. A dribble of sweat courses down the middle of my back. This is how they get you. This is how they crush the spirit right out of you. Out of the blue, the past is rammed down your throat. A gut punch of memories of all the things you took for granted. The things that you lost in the blink of an eye. The stupid, trivial, forgettable things you didn't know could crush you. Things like an old woman's quivery voice, high-pitched and far away, calling you inside for a plate of warm cookies and a glass of ice-cold milk. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. I pull the pin and toss the grenade through the open door. A blinding flash, the terrified chorus of cats screeching, and a human being crying out in pain. I swing into the doorway, sighting the crumpled figure in the far corner of the room, her face hidden behind the swirl of green fire created by my eyepiece. Take her, zombie. One shot and done. But I don't pull the trigger. I'm not sure what stops me. Maybe it's the cats. Dozens of them leaping and diving over and under furniture. Maybe it's her singing. How she reminded me of my grandmother and all the uncountable lost things. Maybe it's Sullivan's story. Her crucifix soldier cowering in a corner, defenseless and doomed. Or maybe it's the simple fact that the light from kerosene lamps placed around the room show me that she isn't armed. Instead of a sniper's rifle, she clutches a wooden spoon.
Please, God, don't kill me!
The old lady shrieks, curling herself into a tight little ball and throwing her hands over her face. I sweep the room quickly. Corners clear, no way in or out except the way I just came. The window facing Main Street is hidden behind heavy black drapes. I step over to it and push the material aside with the muzzle of my rifle. The window's been boarded up. No wonder I didn't see the light from the street. The barrier also tells me this isn't the sniper's nest.
Please don't, she whimpers. Please don't hurt me.
The green fire surrounding her head is bugging me. I yank off the eyepiece. Next to the window is a small table on which a pot of stew burbles over a can of Sterno. There's a Bible next to it, open to the 23rd Psalm. There's a sofa piled with blankets and pillows, a couple of chairs, a desk, a potted plastic tree, listing towers of magazines and newspapers. It's not the sniper kind, but it's definitely a nest. She's probably been holed up here since the third wave rolled through town. And that raises an important question. How'd she make it this long without the resident's silence or finding her? Where is he? I ask. My voice sounds weak and too young to my own ears, like I've fallen backward through time. Where's the shooter?
Shooter?
She echoes. Her gray hair is stuffed into a knit cap, but a few wispy strands have escaped and fall on either side of her pale face. She's wearing black sweatpants, her upper half encased in several layers of sweaters. I step toward her, and she shrinks farther into the corner, clutching the spoon to her chest. Cat hair flits and dances in the smoky golden light, and I sneeze. Bless you, she says, automatically. You had to hear it, I tell her, meaning the shot that took down Dumbo. You have to know he's here.
There's no one here, she squeaks. Just me and my babies. Please don't hurt my babies.
It takes me a second to understand she's talking about the cats. I move around the room, along the narrow paths that wind through the stacks of old magazines, one eye on her, the other looking for weapons. There are 100 places to hide a gun in this clutter. I poke through the mound of blankets on the sofa. I check under the desk, pulling open a couple of drawers, then behind the plastic plant. A cat dashes between my legs, hissing. I weave my way over to her corner and order her to stand up.
Are you going to kill me? She whispers.
I should. I know I should. The risk is in letting her live. The shot that Dumbo took for me came from somewhere in this building. I sling the rifle over my shoulder, draw my sidearm, and order her up again. It's a struggle for both of us. Her physical battle to get her legs beneath her, my psychological one to resist the instinct to help her. Upright, she sways, hands to her chest, worrying with that damn spoon. Drop the spoon.
You want me to drop my spoon?
Drop it.
It's just a spoon.
Drop the damn spoon! She drops the damn spoon. I tell her to face the wall and put her hands on top of her head. She swallows back a sob. I step up behind her, place one hand on top of hers, they're cold as a corpse's, and pat her down. Okay, zombie, she's clean. Now what? Time to fish or cut bait? Maybe she didn't hear the shot. Her hearing may be bad. She is an old lady, after all. Maybe the shooter knows she's here but doesn't bother with her because, after all, she's an old cat lady. What threat can she really pose? Who else is here? I say to the back of her head.
No one. No one, I swear, no one. I haven't seen a living soul in months. Just me and my babies. Just me and my babies.
Turn around, keep your hands on top of your head. She executes a 180, and now I'm looking down into a pair of bright green eyes, nearly lost in folds of withered skin. The mounds of clothes hide how thin she is, but you can see the signs of slow starvation in her face. The cheekbones poking out, the hollows at her temples, the eyes sunken and ringed in black. Her mouth hangs open a little. She has no teeth. Oh, Christ. The last human generation has been forged into killing machines by false hope and lies. And come spring, the fifth wave will roll across the world, slaughtering everyone in its path, including the wounded boys who hide in coolers holding their crucifixes and old cat ladies clutching their wooden spoons. Pull the trigger, zombie. Everybody's luck runs out. If you don't kill her, someone else will. I raise my pistol to the level of her eyes. Chapter 17. She falls to her knees at my feet, and she raises her empty hands toward me. And she doesn't say anything because there isn't anything to say. She's sure she's going to die. They trained me to do this, prepared me for it, emptied me and filled me up again with hate. But I've never shot anyone. Not in all this time. Cassie Sullivan's hands are bloodier than mine. The first time's the hardest, she told me. By the time I shot that last soldier at Camp Haven, I felt nothing. I can't even remember what he looked like.
My friend's been shot. My voice breaks. Either you shot him or someone you know did. Play straight with me.
I don't leave this room. I haven't in weeks. It isn't safe out there, she whispers back. I stay in here with my babies and wait.
Wait? Wait for what?
She's stalling. And I'm stalling too. I don't want to be wrong.
Or right.
I don't want to step over that line and be the person the others have made me. I don't want to kill another human being, innocent or not.
The Lamb of God, she answers. He's coming, you know. Any day now, and the wheat shall be separated from the chaff, the goats from the sheep, and he will come in his glory to judge the living and the dead.
Oh, sure, I choke out. Everybody knows that.
She senses it before I do. I'm not pulling the trigger. I can't. A sweet, childlike smile spreads across the furrowed landscape of her face, like the morning sun breaking over the horizon. I shuffle backward, knocking into the little table by the window. The stew sloshes over the rim of the pot, and the small can of fire beneath it hisses angrily.
My soup,
she cries, struggling to her feet, and I back farther away, keeping the gun on her. But it's a hollow threat. We both know it. The old lady scoops the spoon from the floor and hobbles over to the bubbling pot. The sound of the wood knocking against the metal sides of the pot draws a dozen cats from their hiding places. My stomach tightens. I have eaten nothing but a power bar in over 12 hours. Grandma gives me a sideways look that borders on sly and asks if I'd like a taste. I don't have time, I tell her. I have to get back to my friend. Her eyes fill with tears.
5 minutes, please? I've been so lonely.
She stirs the soup. Ran out of the cans a month ago, but one makes do. Glancing over again, a shy smile.
You could bring your friend here. I have medicines and we can pray for him.
The Lord heals all who ask with a pure heart. My lips are dry, though my mouth is watering. The blood pounds in my ears. A cat rubs against my calf, having decided I'm not such a bad guy after all. That wouldn't be a good idea, I tell her. It isn't safe here. She gives me a startled look.
And there's a place that is?
I almost laugh. She's old, but sharp, and tough, and fearless, and full of faith. She'd have to be to survive this long. Whoever's left now will have her kind of spirit.
What did Cassie call them?
The bent but unbroken ones. For a desperate instant, I consider taking her up on the offer, leaving Dumbo with her while I race to the caverns to find Cup and Ringer. It might be his best chance. No, his only chance. I clear my throat. You ran out of cans? So what's in the soup? She raises the spoon to her lips, closes her eyes, sips the brownish broth. The cat at my feet lifts its mangy head and stares up at me with huge yellow eyes. I know what she's going to say a microsecond before she says it.
Cat.
In one fluid motion, she hurls the scalding liquid toward my face. I stumble backward, knock against a stack of magazines, and lose my balance. She's on me before I hit the floor, her fingers locking around a fistful of my jacket, which she uses to hurl me across the room as easily as a kid throws a stuffed animal. The rifle falls from my shoulder when I hit the far wall. Lying on my side, I point my sidearm at the shimmering blob hurtling toward me. She's too fast, or I'm too slow. She knocks the gun out of my hand, her fingers lock around my throat. She yanks me upright, shoves my head against the wall and brings her face close to mine, her deep green eyes sparkling with infinite malice.
You shouldn't be here, she hisses. It's too soon.
Her face swims into and out of focus. Too soon. Then I understand. She saw the eyepiece. She thinks I'm part of the fifth wave, which won't be launched for another week, after she returns to the mothership. After Urbana and every other city on Earth is gone. I've found the Urbana silencer. Chapter 18.
Change of plans, I gasp. She's allowing me just enough air. The grip of her icy fingers is so hard, the strength behind it so obvious. I'm sure she could snap my neck with a flick of her bony wrist.
That would be bad. Bad for Dumbo, bad for Ringer and Teacup, and especially bad for me. The only thing that's kept me alive is her surprise that I'm here, miles from the nearest base and in a place that won't exist at the week's end. Your fault, zombie. You had the chance to neutralize her and you blew it. Well, she reminded me of my grandmother. Grandma Silencer cocks her head at my response, like a curious bird spying a tasty morsel. Change of plans? That isn't possible. Air support's already been called in, I gasp, desperate to buy time. Didn't you hear the plane? Each second I keep her off balance is another second of life. On the other hand, telling her that bombers are on their way may be the shortest path to the quickest death. I don't believe that, she tells me. I think you're a filthy little liar. My rifle lies a couple of feet away. Very close. Too far. Again, she reminds me of a bird, the way she cocks her head when she looks at me, her head tilted to one side like a damned green-eyed crow. And then I feel it, the violent thrust of an invading consciousness, her consciousness, ripping into me like a drill into soft wood. I feel crushed and flayed open at the same time. There's no part of me hidden from her, nothing safe or sacred. It's like the Wonderland program, only it's not my memories she's mining. It's me. So much pain, she murmurs. So much loss. Her fingers tighten on my throat. Who are you looking for? When I refuse to answer, she cuts off my air. Black stars begin to bloom within my sight. Out of the darkness, my sister calls my name. And I think, Christ, Sullivan, you were right. This she-witch wouldn't have me in a chokehold if I hadn't answered that call. My sister brought me here, not Teacup, not Ringer. My fingertips brush the stock of the rifle. The old cat-eating silencer is laughing in my face, sour-breathed and tooth-deprived, buzz-sawing into my soul, chewing up my life as she chokes it out of me. I can still hear my sister, but now I see Dumbo curled up behind the counter in the coffee shop, crying out for me with his eyes because he has no strength left to speak. I go where you go, Sarge. I left him. Left him like I left my sister, alone and defenseless. Jesus, I even took his gun. Holy crap, the gun! Chapter 19. First shot is at point-blank range, right into her saggy, cat-filled gut. The bullet doesn't break her hold. Unbelievably, she hangs onto my throat, squeezing. I answer with a squeeze of my own. A second shot that lands in the vicinity of her heart. Her roomy eyes widen slightly, and I'm able to worm my arm between our bodies and push her away. Her crabby fingers around my neck loosen, and I suck in a lungful of the sweetest, sour-smelling, dander-infested air I've ever breathed. Grandma Silencer isn't down, though. She's just catching her second wind. She lunges at me. I roll hard to my right. Her head smacks the wall. I fire again. The round smashes through her ribcage, but still, she pushes herself from the wall and crawls toward me, hacking up wads of bright red, oxygen-rich blood. What drives that ancient body is 10,000 years old and contains more hate than the oceans hold water. Plus, she's been augmented by a technology that strengthens and sustains her. Psh, what's a bullet or two? Come here, sonny. Still, I don't think it's the technology that drives her. It's the hate. I back up. She comes on. My heel knocks against a stack of paper and I drop to the floor with a bone-jarring thump. Her ragged claws scratch at my boot. I hold the gun with hands that are bloody at last. Her back bows like a cat stretching on a windowsill. Her mouth opens, but no sound comes out. A lot of blood, but no sound. She makes one last lunge. Her forehead knocks against the muzzle, just as I squeeze the trigger. Chapter 20. I scoop up my rifle, screw the pistol, and bolt from the room. Hall, stairs, bank lobby, street. Finally back at the coffee shop, I crawl behind the counter. You better be alive, you big-eared son of a bitch. He is. Fluttery pulse, shallow breath, ashy skin. but he's alive. So now what? Go back to the safe house? The safest option, the option of minimal risk. The one Ringer would recommend, and she's the expert on risk. Don't know what I'll find at the caverns, even if we manage to reach them. There's another silencer out there. The odds are that Ringer and Cup are already dead, which means that I'm not only marching to my own execution, but bringing Dumbo to his. Unless I leave him here and pick him up on my way back, assuming I make it back. Better for him, better for me. He's a burden now, a liability. So I'll leave him behind after all. Hey, Dumbo, I know you took a bullet for me and everything, but you're on your own, pal. I'm out of here. Isn't that how Ben Parrish rolls? Damn it, zombie, decide already. Dumbo knew the risk and he came anyway. Taking that bullet for you was his call. Going back means he took the bullet for nothing. If he's gonna die, at least give his death meaning. I check the dressing for fresh bleeding. I gently lift his head and slide his rucksack beneath it for a pillow. I take the last syringe of morphine from the med kit and jab it into his forearm. I lean down and whisper, "See, Bo? I came back." Smoothing his hair with my hand, "I got her. The infested bitch who shot you popped her right between the eyes." His forehead is blazing hot beneath my hand. "I can't stay here right now, Bo, but I'm coming back for you. I'm coming back or I'll die trying. Probably die, so don't get your hopes up." I look away from him, but there's nothing else to look at. I'm all jacked up, about to lose it. I'm bouncing from one brutal death to another. Eventually, something very important inside is going to crack. I pull his hand into mine. "Now listen to me, you elephant-eared motherfucker. I'm gonna find Teacup and Ringer, and then we're picking you up on our way back, and we're all going home together, and everything's gonna be fine. Because I'm the Sarge, and that's how I say it's gonna be. You got that? Are you listening to me, soldier? You are not allowed to die. Understand? That's a direct order. You are not allowed to die." His eyes jitter behind the lids. Maybe he's dreaming. Maybe he's sitting in his room playing Call of Duty. I hope so. Then I leave him lying in coffee grounds and wads of paper napkins and scattered coins. Dumbo's alone now, and so am I, plunging into the black, dead heart of Urbana. Squad 53 is gone, broken apart, dead or missing or dying or running. R.I.P. Squad 53.
Chapter 21. Cassie. I have to get this straight. Now. Like, right now. This being my head. 4 a.m. Jazzed up on too much chocolate, thanks, Grace, and too much Evan Walker. Or not enough Evan Walker. That's an inside joke, if you can make inside jokes in a private journal. I'll get to the private parts later. Ha, another joke. You know you've reached a very sad place when the only person who can make you laugh is yourself. The house is quiet. Not even a whisper of wind against the boarded-up window. The silence of the void. As if the world stopped breathing and I'm the last person on Earth. Again. Damn, I wish there was someone I could talk to. Ben and Dumbo are gone. All I have left are Sam, Megan, and Evan. Two are asleep in their room. The other. Other? Ha! It's really pitiful. Is awake and on watch and is someone with whom the more I talk, the more crooked my head gets. For over a month now, he's been fading away. Here and then not here. Talking, then saying nothing. Mr. Spaceman staring off into space. Damn it, Evan, where have you gone? I think I know, but knowing why doesn't help my feelings of Evanlessness. And somehow neither does the smell of his aftershave lingering in the room. After Ben left, Evan shaved. He washed his hair and scrubbed a week's worth of grime from his body. He even trimmed his nails and addressed his neglected cuticles. When he came into this room, he looked like the old Evan, the first Evan, the Evan I believed to be a fully human Evan. I miss that Evan, the one who pulled me frozen from the ice pack and thawed me out and made me hamburgers and pretended to be something he wasn't and hid the thing he was. The calm, quiet, steady, reliable, strong Evan. Not this other Evan, the tortured, haunted, conflicted Evan who clips off his sentences as if he's afraid he'll say too much. The Evan who's already gone, already up there, 200 miles up with no way back down. Not their Evan. My Evan. The imperfectly perfect guy. Why do we always get the Evan we deserve instead of the Evan we want? Chapter 22. I don't know why I bother writing this. No one will ever read it. And if you do, Evan, I will murder you. I suppose I could turn to Bear. It was always easy to talk to him. We had hours of conversation, good conversation, during those weeks when it was just me and him hiding in the woods. Bear's an excellent listener. He never yawns or interrupts or walks away, never disagrees, never plays games, never lies. I go where you go always. That's Bear's jam. Bear proves that true love doesn't have to be complicated, or even reciprocated. Evan, in case you're reading this, I'm dumping you for a teddy bear. Not that you and I were ever a couple. I was never one of those girls who daydreamed about her wedding day or meeting the perfect guy or raising 3.2 kids in the burbs. When I thought about the future, it usually involved a big city and a career, or living in a cabin somewhere leafy like Vermont, writing books and taking long walks with a dog I'd name Pericles or some other random Greek name to show people how educated and cultured I was. Or maybe I'd be a doctor treating sick kids in Africa. Something meaningful. Something worthwhile that maybe somebody someday would notice and then give me a plaque or an award or name a street after me. Sullivan Avenue. Cassiopeia Way. Guys didn't enter into my daydreams much. In college, I was going to have sex. Not drunken sex, or sex with the first guy who asked, or sex just to say, hey, I had sex, the way people try exotic food, like, hey, I had fried grasshopper. It would be with someone I cared about. Love wasn't necessary, but mutual respect and curiosity and tenderness would be nice. And he would also be someone I found attractive. Too much sex is wasted on people who aren't. Why would you sleep with someone who didn't turn you on? But people do. Or they used to. No, they probably still do. Why am I thinking about sex? Okay, that's insincere. That's a lie. Dear God, Cass, if you can't be honest in your own private journal, where can you be? Instead of saying what's true, you make inside jokes and sly references like, one day a million years from now, somebody will read this and embarrass the hell out of you. Seriously. At least when he showed up tonight, he knocked first. Evan always had an issue with boundaries. He rapped on the door, then entered in stages. Head, shoulders, torso, legs. Stood there in the doorway for a minute. Is it okay? I noticed the change immediately. Newly shaven, hair still wet. Wearing a fresh pair of jeans and an Ohio State t-shirt. I can't remember the last time, or really the first time, I saw Evan exercise his Second Amendment right to bear arms. Evan Walker has biceps. It's not important to mention this fact, as biceps are muscles most people have. I just thought I'd mention it. I was kind of hoping for an aw shucks look. I'd seen it often enough in the old farmhouse back in the day, when that was his go-to expression. Instead, I got the furrowed brow and the slightly downturned mouth and the dark, troubled eyes of a poet contemplating the void, which I guess he was. Not a poet, but a contemplator of the void. I made a space for him on the bed. There was nowhere else to sit. Though we'd never done the deed, it felt like we were old lovers forced into an awkward post-split negotiation over who gets the silverware and how the souvenirs from all their trips together are going to be divvied up. Then I smelled the Ralph Lauren aftershave. I don't know why Grace kept a stash of men's grooming products. Maybe they belonged to the former owners of the house and she never bothered to get rid of them. Or maybe she had sex with her victims before chopping off their heads or ripping out their hearts or eating them alive like a black widow spider. He'd nicked his chin shaving. There was a dab of white styptic stuff on the cut, a tiny mar in his otherwise otherworldly beautiful face, which was a relief. Flawlessly beautiful people annoy the hell out of me. I checked on the kids, he said, as if I'd asked if he checked on the kids. And? They're okay. Sleeping. Who's on the watch? He stared at me for a couple of uncomfortable seconds. Then he looked down at his hands. I looked, too. He was so perfectly put together when we met that I thought I'd lucked into the most narcissistic person left on the planet. It makes me feel more human, he told me, meaning grooming. Later, when I found out he wasn't quite human, I thought I understood what he was getting at. Even later, and by even later I mean now, I realized cleanliness isn't necessarily next to godliness, but it is damn near indistinguishable from humanness. It'll be okay, he said softly. No, it won't, I shot back. Ben and Dumbo are going to die. You're going to die. I'm not going to die, leaving out Ben and Dumbo. How are you getting out of the mothership once you set the bombs? The same way I got in. The last time you took a ride in one of your little pods, you broke several bones and nearly died. It's a hobby, he said with a crooked smile. Nearly dying. I looked away from his hands. The hands that lifted me when I fell, held me when I was cold, fed me when I was hungry, healed me when I was hurt, washed me when I was covered in forest filth and blood. You're going to destroy your entire civilization, and for what? For a girl. You would think a sacrifice like that would make me feel just a little bit special. It didn't. It felt weird. Like one of us was batshit crazy and that person wasn't me. I couldn't see a single romantic element in genocide, but maybe that's just my lack of insight into the nature of love, having never been in love. Would I wipe out humanity to save Evan? Not likely. Of course, there's more than one kind of love. Would I kill everyone in the world to save Sam? That's not an easy question to answer. Those times you nearly died, you were sort of protected, though, right? I asked. The technology that made you superhuman, which you said crashed on the way to the hotel. You won't have that this time. He shrugged. There's the aw shucks thing I thought I missed. Seeing it again reminded me how far we'd traveled from the farmhouse, and I fought the urge to slap it off his face. What you're going to do, it isn't for me, or it isn't just for me. You get that, right? There's no other way to stop it, Cassie, he said, slingshotting back to his tormented poet look. What about the way you mentioned right before the last time you almost died? Remember? Rigging Megan's throat bomb to blow it up? Hard to do without the bomb, he said. Grace didn't have a stash hidden in the house somewhere. Instead, she kept the place well stocked with men's aftershave. Post-apocalyptic priorities. Grace's assignment wasn't to blow things up. It was to kill people. And have sex with them. I didn't mean for that to come out. But I don't mean to say about 80% of what I say. Really, though, who cares if they had sex? It's a silly thing to worry about when the fate of the planet hangs in the balance. Trivial. Unimportant. The hands that held me holding Grace. The body that warmed me warming hers. The lips that touched mine touching hers. It doesn't matter. I don't care. Grace is dead. I plucked at the sheets and wished I hadn't said it. Grace lied. We never... I don't care, Evan, I told him. It's not important. Anyway, Grace was a fantastically good-looking homicidal killing machine. Who could say no? He placed a hand over mine to still my plucking fingers. I would tell you if we had. What a liar. I could fill the Grand Canyon with all the things he's refused to tell me. I pulled my hand away and looked right into those chocolate fondue fountain eyes. You're a liar, I said. He surprised me by nodding. I am, but not about that. I am? What have you lied about? He shook his head. Silly human girl. About who I really was. And who is that exactly? You've told me what you were, but you've never said who you are. Who are you, Evan Walker? Where do you come from? What did you look like before you looked like nothing? What was your planet like? Did it look like ours? Were there plants and trees and rocks? And did you live in cities? And what did you do for fun? And was there music? Music is universal, like mathematics. Can you sing me a song? Sing me an alien song, Evan. Tell me what it was like growing up. Did you go to school, or was knowledge just downloaded into your brain? What were your parents like? Did they have jobs like human parents? Brothers and sisters? Sports? Start anywhere.
We had sports.
With a tiny, indulgent smile. I don't like sports. Start with music.
We had music, too.
I'm listening. I folded my arms over my chest and waited. His mouth opened. His mouth closed. I couldn't tell if he was about to laugh or cry.
It isn't that simple, Cassie.
I'm not expecting performance quality. I can't carry a tune either, but that never kept me from lighting up a little Beyonce.
Who?
Oh, come on. You gotta know who she was. He shook his head. Maybe he didn't grow up on a farm, but under a rock. Then I thought it would be a little odd for a 10,000-year-old super being to have his finger on the pulse of pop culture. Still, we're talking about Beyonce. He's even weirder than I thought.
Everything is different. Structurally, I mean.
He pointed at his mouth, stuck out his tongue. I can't even pronounce my own name. For a moment, the pathos was so thick it almost snuffed out the lamp. Then hum something, or whistle. Could you whistle, or didn't you have lips?
None of that matters anymore, Cassie.
You're wrong. It matters a lot. Your past is what you are, Evan. Tears welled in his eyes. It was like watching chocolate melt.
God, Cassie, I hope not.
He lifted his freshly scrubbed hands with their trimmed and buffed nails toward me. The hands that held the gun that slaughtered innocent people before he almost murdered me.
If the past is what we are.
I might have pointed out that we've all done things we aren't proud of, but that was too flippant, even for me. Damn it, Cassie, why were you forcing him to think about that? I was so obsessed with the past I didn't know about that I forgot the one I did. To save the ones he had come to destroy, Evan Walker the Silencer was planning to silence an entire civilization, his civilization, forever. No, Ben Parrish, I thought. Not for a girl. For the past he can't escape. For the 7 billion. Your little sister, too. Before I knew what was happening or even how it happened, I was holding him with hands that had never comforted him, never lifted him up, never found him when he was lost. I was the taker, the recipient, always. From the moment he pulled me from that snowbank, I have been his charge, his mission, his cross. Cassie's pain, Cassie's fear, Cassie's anger, Cassie's despair. These have been the nails that impaled him. I stroked his damp hair. I rubbed his arched back. I pressed his smooth, sweet-smelling face into my neck, and his tears were warm against my skin. He whispered something that sounded like Mayfly. Heartless bitch would have been more accurate. I'm sorry, Evan, I whispered. I'm so sorry. I bowed my head. He raised his. I kissed his wet cheek. Your pain, your fear, your anger, your despair. Give them to me, Evan. I'll carry them for a while. He reached up and ran his fingertips lightly over my lips, moist with his tears. The last person on earth, he murmured.
Do you remember when you wrote that?
I nodded. Stupid. He shook his head.
I think that's what did it. When I read that. The last person on earth. Because I felt the same way.
My hands were mauling that old OSU shirt. It was very maulable. That's a good word, maulable. It applies to so many things. You're not coming back, I said, because he couldn't say it. His fingers combed through my hair. I shivered. Don't do that, you bastard. Don't touch me like you'll never touch me again. Don't look at me like you'll never see me again. I shut my eyes. Our lips touched. The last person on earth. With my eyes closed, I could see her walking down a wooded path in Vermont, a place she has never been and will never go,
and the leaves that embrace the trail sing arias of bright red and gold. And there is a big dog named Pericles running ahead of her in that self-important way of dogs. And she has everything she ever wanted, this girl. No, this woman. Nothing left behind, nothing left undone. She traveled the world and wrote books and took lovers and broke hearts. She didn't allow life just to happen to her. She punched and pummeled and beat the living shit out of it. She mauled it. His breath hot in my ear. I'm clawing at his chest, digging my nails into his skin, the hungry lioness with her catch. Resistance is futile, Walker. I'll never take that path in the Golden Woods or own a dog named Pericles or travel the world. There'll be no recognition of a life well lived, no street named after me, no difference in the world because I once occupied it. My life is a catalog of the undone and the never will be done. The others stole all of my unmade memories, but I won't let them steal this one. My hands roamed his body, an undiscovered country, which henceforth I shall call Evanland. Hills and valleys, desert plains and forest glens, the landscape pockmarked with the scars of battle, crisscrossed by fault lines and unexpected vistas. And I am Cassie the Conquistador. The more territory I conquer, the more I want. His chest heaved, a subterranean quake that rose to the surface like a tsunamic wave. His eyes were wide and wet and filled with something that closely resembled fear. Cassie, shut up. My mouth surveying the valley beneath his rolling chest. His fingers entangled now in my hair. We shouldn't. I almost laughed. Well, the shouldn't list is awfully long, Evan. I scored my teeth across his stomach. The land beneath my tongue quivered, shock and aftershock. Shouldn't. No, we probably shouldn't. Some cravings can never be satisfied. Some discoveries demean the quest. Not the time, he gasped. I rested my cheek on his tummy and tugged the hair from my eyes. When is the time, Evan? His hands captured my roving ones and held them still. You said you loved me, I whispered. Damn you, Evan Walker. Why did you ever say such a ridiculous, crazy, imbecilic thing? No one tells you how close rage is to lust. I mean, the space between molecules is thicker. You're a liar, I told him. You're the worst kind of liar, the kind who lies to themselves. You're not in love with me. You're in love with an idea. His eyes cut away. That's how I knew I nailed him. What idea? He asked. Liar, you know what idea. I got up. I pulled off my shirt. I stared him down, daring him to look at me. Look at me, Evan. Look at me. Not the last person on Earth, the stand-in for all the people you shot on the highway. I'm not the Mayfly. I'm Cassie, an ordinary girl from an ordinary place who was dumb enough or unlucky enough to live long enough for you to find. I am not your charge, your mission, or your cross. I am not humanity. He turned his face toward the wall, hands beside his head as if in surrender. Well, I'd gone this far. I tugged the jeans over my hips and kicked them away. I couldn't remember a time when I was this angry, or this sad, or this... I wanted to punch him, caress him, kick him, hold him. I wanted him to die. I wanted me to die. I wasn't self-conscious, not at all, and it wasn't because he'd seen me naked before. He had. That time, I didn't have a choice. Then I'd been unconscious, close to death. Now I was awake and very much alive. I wished there were 100 lamps to light me up. I wanted a spotlight and a magnifying glass so he could examine every imperfectly perfect human inch of me. It's not about the time, Evan, I reminded him, but what we do with it. Chapter 23, Ringer. At 35,000 feet, it's hard to tell which seems smaller, the earth below or the person above it, looking down.
due north and a couple of miles from the caverns, Constance unbuckles her harness and grabs her chute assembly from the overhead. One last check through before the jump. Will be inserted from this altitude to reduce the chance of being spotted from the ground. It's called a halo insertion. High altitude, low opening. Risky as hell, but no more risky than jumping from 5,000 feet with no parachute at all. Constance must know about my jump from the doomed chopper because she says, "Gonna be a lot easier than last time, huh?" I tell her to fuck off and she grins at me. I'm glad. I want to find nothing sympathetic or likable about her. Those things might make killing her hard. Well, harder. I'm still going to kill her.
30 seconds!
The pilot's voice squawks in our ears. Constance checks my assembly. I check hers. We toss our headsets onto the seats as the rear bay door opens. Sliding our gloved fingers over the guide cable, we shuffle toward the screaming maw, the sub-zero wind like a fist pummeling our faces. My stomach tightens as the C-160 rocks side to side, buffeted by turbulence. I've been fighting the urge to throw up for nearly the entire flight. Better to do it now than in free fall. If I position myself correctly, the vomit will land directly in Constance's face. I wonder why the hub doesn't subdue my digestive system. Weird, but I feel let down by a trusted friend. I follow Constance into the black gullet of a moonless night. We won't deploy the chutes until well after we've reached terminal velocity. I can see her clearly with my enhanced vision, 50 feet farther down and off to my left. Time slows as my speed picks up. I'm not sure if that's the hub's doing or a natural reaction to falling at 120 miles per hour. I don't hear the plane. The world is wind. 20,000 feet. 15. 10. I can make out a highway, rolling fields, clusters of bare-limbed trees. The closer I get, the faster they seem to rush toward me. 5,000 feet. 4. Minimum distance to ground for a safe deployment is 800 feet, but that's pushing the envelope. Constance pulls her cord at 850. I'm a little below that, and the ground roars toward me like the face of a runaway locomotive. I bend my knees on impact and duck my shoulder toward the ground, rolling twice before stopping flat on my back, tangled in cords. Constance is there before I can take my next breath, slicing me free with her combat knife. She yanks me to my feet, gives me a thumbs up, and then takes off across the field toward a couple of silos that stand next to the ubiquitous red barn and, a stone's throw away, the White Farmhouse. White House, red barn, a narrow country lane. We couldn't have fallen into a more quintessential slice of Americana. The name of the hamlet where the caverns are? West Liberty. I join her at the base of a silo, where she's busy stripping off her jumpsuit. Beneath it, she's wearing mom jeans and a hoodie. She has no weapon except the knife, which she tucks into a sheath strapped to her leg. "Half a click south and west of our position," she breathes. "The entrance to the caverns. We're a couple of hours ahead of them." Zombie and whoever was crazy enough to come with him to look for me and Teacup. Pound cake, probably. My gut tightens at the thought of telling Zombie about Teacup. "You hang here and wait for my signal." I shake my head. "I'm coming with you." She flashes that goddamn stupid smile. "Honey, you don't want to do that." "Why?" "Our cover story won't fly if there's anyone around to contradict it." The vice around my stomach tightens another turn. Survivors. Constance is going to kill everyone she finds hiding in those caves. And that's probably a lot of people. Dozens, maybe hundreds. It will be tough work. They'll be well-armed and wary of strangers. It's hard to imagine that anyone's unaware of the fourth wave this late in the game. Which means I might not have to kill Constance after all. Maybe they'll do it for me. It's a pleasant thought. Unrealistic, but pleasant. My next thought is not pleasant at all, so I blurt out the first thing that pops into my head. "We don't need to take the caverns. We can intercept Zombie before he gets there." Constance shakes her head. "Not our orders." "Our orders are to rendezvous with Zombie," I argue. I'm not letting this go. If I let it go, innocent people will die. I'm not totally against people dying, I am planning to kill her and Evan Walker, but this is avoidable.
I know it bothers you, Marika, she says kindly. That's why I'm going in solo. It's a stupid risk. You've reached a conclusion without knowing all the facts, she scolds me. That's been a problem from the beginning, as in the beginning of human history. My hand drops to the butt of my sidearm. She doesn't miss it. Her answering smile lights up the night. You know what happens if you do that, she says gently, a kindly aunt, a caring big sister. Your friends, the ones you've come back for, how many lives are their lives worth? If 100 had to die so they could live, or 1,000, or 10,000, or 10 million, when would you say enough? I know this argument. It's Vosh's. It's theirs. What are 7 billion lives when existence itself is at stake? My throat burns. I can taste stomach acid in my mouth. It's a false choice, I answer. One last try, a plea. You don't have to kill anyone to get Walker. She shrugs. Apparently, I'm just not getting it. If I don't, neither of us is going to live long enough to have that chance. She lifts her chin and turns her face slightly away. Hit me. Taps her right cheek. Here. Why not? The blow rocks her back on her heels. She shakes her head impatiently, turns the other cheek. Again. Harder this time, Marika. Hard. I hit her harder. Hard enough to break bone. Her left eye immediately begins to swell. She feels no pain from the punch. Neither do I. Thanks, she says brightly. No problem. Anything else you need busted, let me know. She laughs softly. If I didn't know better, I'd swear she likes me, finds me charming. Then she's gone so quickly that only enhanced vision like mine could follow her, zipping across the field to the road that leads to the caverns, then cutting into the woods on the northwest side. As soon as she's out of sight, I sink to the ground, shaky, lightheaded, my gut churning. I'm beginning to wonder if something is wrong with the 12th system. I feel like shit. I lean against the cold metal of the silo and close my eyes. The darkness behind my lid spins around an invisible center, the singularity before the universe was born. Teacup is there, falling away from me. The blast from Razor's weapon resounds in timeless space. She falls away, but she will always be mine. Razor is there too, in the absolute center of absolute nothing, the blood still fresh on his arm from the self-inflicted wound, VQP. And he knew the cost of sacrificing Teacup would be his own life. I'm certain by the time we spent the night together, he'd already decided to kill her, because killing her was the only way to set me free. Free me to do what, Razor? Endure so I can conquer what? With my eyes still closed, I pull the combat knife from the sheath strapped to my calf. I can imagine Razor lingering in the doorway to the warehouse, the golden light from the pyre outside washing over his lean features, his eyes lost in shadow as he rolls up his sleeve. The knife in his hand then, the knife in my hand now. He probably winced when the tip broke the skin. I do not. I feel nothing. I am cocooned in nothingness. The answer, after all, to Vosh's riddle of why. I can smell Razor's blood. I can't smell mine, because none breaks the surface of the wound. Thousands of microscopic drones staunch the flow. V. How do you conquer the unconquerable? Q. Who can win when no one can endure? P. What endures when all hope is gone? Out of the singularity, a voice cries out, "My dear child, why do you cry?" I open my eyes. It's a priest. Chapter 24. At least, he's dressed like one. Black pants, black shirt, white collar yellowed by sweat, spotted with rust-colored stains. He's standing just outside my reach.
A small guy with a receding hairline and a pudgy, babyish face. He sees the wet knife in my hand and immediately raises his. I am not armed. His voice is high-pitched, as childlike as his features. I drop the knife and draw my sidearm. Hands on top of your head. Kneel. He obeys instantly. I glance toward the road. What happened to Constance? I didn't mean to startle you, the little guy says. It's just that I haven't seen another person in months. You're with the military, yes? Shut up, I tell him. Don't talk. Of course, sorry. His mouth clamps shut. His cheeks are flushed with fear or maybe embarrassment. I step behind him. He remains very still while I run my free hand over his torso. Where did you come from? I ask. Pennsylvania? No, where did you come from just now? I've been living in the caves. With who? No one. I told you I haven't seen anyone in months. Since November. A hard metal object in his right-hand pocket. I fish it out. A crucifix. It's seen better days. The cheap gold finish is chipped. The face of Christ has been worn down to a bald nub. I think of Sullivan's crucifix soldier cowering behind the beer coolers. Please, he whimpers. Don't take that. I toss the crucifix into the tall, dead grass between the silos and the barn. Where the hell is Constance? How did this dweeby little guy slip past her? More important, how did I let this dweeby little guy sneak up on me? Where's your coat? I ask him.